Good evening and welcome to Big Talk on WMPG on this snowy Thursday evening. My name is Stephen Emmons, and tonight on Big Talk is award-winning journalist and author Colin Woodard. Colin has written articles for the Christian Science Monitor, Down East Magazine, and the Daily Beast, and as well as other media outlets as well. He has authored several books, including his most recent, American Nations, a History of 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. And you can follow Colin's blog at colinwoodard.blogspot.com. Originally, welcome. First of all, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Colin.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And thanks for braving the elements for coming out.
Absolutely. I live in the hood, so I could walk through the snowstorm.
Excellent. So originally, I'd hoped to talk to you about the article you wrote in the Portland Phoenix, The Making of Paula Page, which was a two-part series that ran in late January. But since you've agreed to come on the show, we've had some pretty big political developments here in Maine, and which have national ramifications. So we'll definitely hit on those as well.
Sounds good. Yeah, they're in turmoil. The musical chairs have begun as Senator Snow departs.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting few months before November. So we'd love to have you back on again to talk more about that. So I'd like to start by asking you to read an excerpt from your article from the Portland Phoenix about the making of Paula Page.
Sure. And this was essentially a biography, which I spent months doing, of the governor. So the sort of nut graph of the story is that an examination of LePage's life reveals a focused, hardworking youth who escaped poverty by gaining the attention of private benefactors and who thinks others can do the same. A successful manager schooled in the old industrial economy, a sector whose interests dominate his economic, environmental, and labor policies. A leader unafraid to impose austerity measures, but who has always done so by intimidating, rather than co-opting, would-be opponents. And a governor who, a half century removed from his days on the streets, still takes pride in the rules he sometimes bent to get ahead.
Great. And it's a really long series. I mean, it was broken into two parts in the Portland Phoenix, so...
Yeah, I think it's 10,000 words, so yeah, quite an extensive piece, yeah.
How long did it take you to from start to finish?
Well, I was working on it part-time in the background, about 6 or 7 months, yeah, altogether.
So really it was from before, probably about halfway into his first year.
Yeah, I think I started working on it sort of in June, roughly, and it was funded in part by the Fund for Investigative Journalism in Washington, D.C., a grant from them. Which allowed me to really dig in and do public records requests and take the time to really assemble a story and picture of the forces that shaped the governor and getting some sense of, you know, what his worldview is and why.
Great. So I think basically we can break down LePage's history into a few different categories. Growing up in Little Canada, in Lewiston, then his time on the streets. When he was at St. Mary's Grammar School and then again at Lewiston High School and then going off to Husson College, managing lumber factories in northern Maine, and then overseeing other companies like Scott Paper, Down East Peat, and then going into politics in Waterville and then becoming working at Martin's and then now his stint at being governor. But I'm really interested in starting, you know, a lot of the times LePage on the campaign trail, what's a year and a half ago now, really was highlighting his youth in Lewiston and growing up on the streets. Can you talk a little bit about what Lewiston was like post-World War II in the 40s and 50s, sort of in his early formative years?
Yeah, the picture in talking to people who were there at the time is that it was a very tight-knit neighborhood. By the time LePage was in his youth in the 1950s and early 1960s, it had had a reputation in other parts of town as being absolutely the wrong side of tracks and the dangerous place with, you know, speakeasies and ne'er-do-wells. But the sense I got from talking to people who grew up with LePage in the neighborhood is that wasn't really, it may have been true in the past, but by then it wasn't really a fair depiction of the neighborhood. It was densely populated and tenements, houses, and people... you know, French was the first language and people went to mass on Sundays, but it was people watched out for each other. It was tightly knit in a good sense as well. I mean, people were poor, but over and over again, people I talked to remarked on how there was this quiet looking out for one another, particularly children. And it was always done in a very non-flashy, you know, under the table kind of way, because I think people had pride not to be taking handouts. So, you know, there was somebody who lived in the neighborhood or owned a metal manufacturing business across the street from the LePages who would suddenly just pick up, you know, the poor waifs in the neighborhood every once in a while and drive on down to the downtown stores on Main Street or Lisbon Street and buy them a whole new outfit of clothes, you know, kids who were in rags, and just drop them off back at their door. And that, you know, and no thanks, no, you know, it was just something that you kind of did. And people, over and over again, I heard about how people, if you did something wrong as a kid, that it would get back to your parents, you know, before you even got home, sort of thing. But also that people sort of looked out and quietly tried to, you know, take care of each other in a way that would be kind of unusual now. Now the world's changed in a lot of those respects, but those informal social structures really did work back then. And thankfully so for the governor, because his family was in extremely precarious situation. And
he's one of 17 kids.
Yeah,
right?
17. Wow. Yeah, I think 18 if you count a child apparently from an earlier marriage. So yeah, there weren't 18 kids when he left, because he's one of the eldest. He's the eldest boy. So when he left, I think there were, you know, 8 or 9 or something. But yeah, it was, you can imagine. And his father was by that time, you know, a laborer first in the mill, and then appears to have been sort of unskilled day laborer. And yeah, it's a very grim sounding situation.
Talk a little bit more about Paul LePage's father, Gerard. That's his name, right?
Yeah, right.
I think a lot of the bravado that I think LePage portrays in the media was sort of influenced in a lot of the ways by growing up with an abusive father. A father who was, in your article, you mentioned that he was actually discharged from the army because basically he wasn't bright enough to be in the army. And this is during World War II.
Yeah, I mean, I was curious. The picture that forms from things that the governor has said and that his siblings have said to the media in the past are that, yeah, this was a horribly abusive and violent guy when he was drinking, and he would do that all weekends and, you know, terrorizing, beating up the kids, and trying to set fire to the house when they're all asleep, kind of stuff. I mean, it sounds like an extremely precarious existence. And there are siblings who, you know, one of them died at 4 of gastroenteritis after 2 weeks. And I mean, it just sounds like a very difficult circumstance. And I was curious, you know, what, you know, you wonder what makes somebody do all these things. Yes, you have 18 kids, but what, you know, are there other factors? And yes, he'd been a World War II veteran, I knew. So I was curious on the, did he, you know, was he a Marine who fought in Iwo Jima, was trapped in Guadalcanal?
Yeah.
But yeah, his military records, I was surprised that, in fact, he'd gone to basic training and been sent back for a category called anapnus, which meant he wasn't suitable for military service, an honorable discharge. But yeah, he either was considered to lack the cognitive ability to it, or something about his personality wasn't going to allow him to function properly in the military, so he was sent home. But, you know, what is that? If you have 18 children, and it sounds like he already had some strikes against him of some sort, who knows what was going on, but you can imagine the pressure that the family and the precarious situation the children would have been under if the primary wage earner is already, you know, at the height, 1943, at the height of the war, he wasn't even suitable for the draft. It must have limited the possibilities. And yeah, it sounds like a terrible grind.
After an especially violent episode, LePage leaves his house and ends up spending his early teens and throughout high school living not under his parents' roof, specifically for that. And you mentioned that he didn't, even going back to his father, when his father was on his deathbed, he wouldn't even go back and sleep under the same roof as his dad.
Yeah, that's LePage just said that from the governor in his office wouldn't ultimately cooperate with the interview. So I was able to assemble and listen to hours and hours of his public remarks and attend a couple of his public forum and assemble a picture. And yes, in his own words, yes, that's all in fact the case. He's about 11, and you know, it's part of his campaign stump speech that he was delivered a violent beating. I think he dislocated or broke his jaw or something along those lines, and was he just decided that was that. He wasn't going to go home at that point. Lived some sort of, you know, existence. He's described as on the streets, and I'm sure that must have occurred for a certain length of time. That it's a little bit murky. Was he literally on the streets? You know, he was working for a cafe that turns out to be next door to his parents' house in this tightly knit neighborhood, and his childhood friends don't remember him leaving school or anything. I'm sure it was a difficult circumstance, but he you know, tenaciously did in fact fight through it through various means, and yeah, there's sort of two pivot points in his lifetime. One is that he manages to go from that situation of being on the streets and having fled a domestic violence situation, having all his other siblings there, to successfully managing to get into college. And then there's that second pivot point where he converts from being a small town mayor to the highest elected office in the state. So there's a, you know, amazing drive in there somewhere, which you can imagine.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think sort of struck me as part of that early part of his years, too, is that his distrust for, like, the Department of Human Services, right. You know, when it came to, like, with them intervening with his family, which, you know, I wonder if that's really had any effect on his recent sort of crackdown on DHS.
Oh, I think it has to. I mean, all those, everything we know about his feelings about the Health and Human Services in regards to his own family background are from things he's said in interviews in the past to the press. And, yeah, you know, the clutches of the DHS, and that it creates a culture of dependency, and you know that it in itself destroys people. He definitely has that. You get the impression that if you look at his biography and how he got out of that situation, he was incredibly hardworking and driven and directed. And yeah, he would take shortcuts along the way if he needed to, but impressive in that regard. But that wouldn't have mattered if he hadn't had helping hands at the right moments, and he did. I mean, yeah, he was
very fortunate.
Peter Snow, Olympia Snow's first husband, later Mickey Marden, yep. Chesley Husley, the founder of Husson College, giving him an opportunity even to take a key examination in French in order to enter under probation.
Bending the rules a little bit all along the way.
Absolutely. Many instances, his first job out of college that got him in a managerial role as soon as he's graduated from Husson was through his new wife's family, you know, that they owned the company. So he was sort of working for his in-laws. I mean, so yeah, he had many hands up, and that's great, you know, more power to him. But the impression I got is that the lessons he took from all that are that somehow there seems to be an assumption that that is available to everybody else who's in that kind of precarious situation. You know, there's sort of in both the statements he's made in the press and in some of his policies, sort of this atmosphere of contemptuousness towards a certain segment of those who are on welfare and need support services, that somehow they're basically sponging the system. You know, that if they worked hard, that some private benefactor would come along and lend them a hand, just like happened to
him.
LePage,
yeah.
Which I don't think, you know, I think that's where the lessons of his past come in, is that he thinks that others can do what he did, and he was, I think, very fortunate. And again, more power to him, but I don't think that's informed a distorted idea.
Yeah, we live in a very different time now.
Even in that time, I think he was fortunate. But now, and that just doesn't happen the same way. And Little Canada's not like that now. And certainly, you know, it's not like that in Dover, Foxcroft, and even parts of Portland.
Right. One thing that, you know, we're about halfway through our show, and in case you folks are joining us, our guest on Big Talk tonight is Colin Woodard, journalist and author of numerous things. And tonight we're talking about Paula Page, about an article that Colin, you wrote on the Portland Phoenix in January. And also we're going to be turning really quickly to Olympia Snow and the big news from Washington that's just come down the pike this week. One thing that I want to, just before we move on from LePage, I mean, you've spent, you know, 6 months interviewing people who knew him from his background, listening to his speeches. What, did you get a better sense of who he is as a person? Did you gain any sort of respect that you hadn't had for him before? Or what was your, you know, we all have our media bias, our personal political biases, but how is any of that filtered through what you knew about him before and then now after researching him and really focusing on him?
I think that, I mean, what he did and accomplished in the first, you know, 30 years of his life is incredibly impressive story. I mean, it's has an operatic quality. You know, he's going from Dickens to pulling himself up by his bootstraps. It's an incredible story. And when you come out at the other end, when he's entering the political world, Mickey Marden, the founder of Marden, sort of emerges as the political mentor who kind of brought him into that world and in some sense seems to be a role model for him. It almost seems like something happened in between that I haven't been able to put my finger on, but the policies and things that he's adopted and his political attitudes and goals in office. It's interesting trying to trace the lessons from the earlier part of his career with that. That's the mismatch I find that I try to understand in looking at his story, and the very impressive in what he accomplished, and peculiar in the lessons he drew from that experience.
Right, and how it's been executed as well.
And I mean, and some of them are more clear. I mean, his concern about environmental policies and the desire to roll back labor and environmental issues. I mean, in the time he was a consultant working with a lot of distressed industrial companies, he was, you know, the environmental and labor issues seemed to foil his plans for making some of these companies recover. I mean, some of that's from his personal experience, but other elements, like you say, in terms of social policy and stuff, one could have had similar experiences to him and come out with a different set of lessons, and it's interesting seeing that. It's an amazing human story.
And it will be very interesting to see how his policies continue to play out. You know, especially one of the other things you've done a lot of research on is his political money that he's gotten from outside PAC organizations as well. And some of the connections with the Koch brothers and how they've been really influential in writing certain key legislative
The people who were responsible for crafting key pieces of the governor's agenda, will have ties with the American Legislative Exchange Council, which the Koch brothers found. And there's a lot of at least, one degree separation ties in the people he's chosen to trust. And there's the biggest concerns I had in investigative reporting is discovering that so much of the agenda was literally cut and pasted from memos solicited from industrial interests by an advisor who was still a paid and registered lobbyist of many of those same interests. In other words, this person's contractual job was to represent them, not the people of Maine or even LePage's own worldviews. And that's what that's about and why that amount of trust was placed in people who clearly had, literally had contractual obligations to others is remains a mystery, but is certainly something that would raise eyebrows.
Well, let's change gears a little bit, and we'll go on to talk a little bit about Olympia Snow, who is one of LePage's early, well, I guess not early backers, because she really waited until the primary was through to get
her support. I mean,
but they do go way back with her husband,
right? And she's from Auburn, and is also, you know, she was orphaned at a relatively young age, and so there are some common experiences there. You definitely get the impression when LePage speaks about that he feels sort of a emotional connection, that they have shared a trajectory. I'm not as clear one way or the other whether there's that same sort of emotional intensity from Senator Snow's camp. It's hard to tell, and I didn't have access to actually interview directly, but it goes way back.
Well, you've written a blog post for the Daily Beast, an online article for the Daily Beast that was published yesterday, the Olympia Snow, why she's leaving the Senate. You know, it's really hard to tell right now with, you know, she's had a couple interviews, I think, on MSNBC, and then she'll be making a big press conference tomorrow in Portland. And so what are your initial reactions from the big news out of Washington this
week? I mean, I was surprised. Like most people, I wasn't expecting it. It wouldn't have shocked me if months ago she'd decided not to step down. But the fact that she was withdrawing from the race this late in the process, when she was raising money and appeared to be, you know, all in, and then all of a sudden, with only, 15 days left for people to file signatures to replace her, she's pulling out.
Yeah.
So the timing I found remarkable, and it completely reshapes, you know, it's a game of musical chairs in Maine politics now, because with her leaving what was a uncontestable seat, really, suddenly the people who are going to run for Congress are trying to move up for that seat, and there's this scramble, and we have John Baldacci and Angus King talking about moving for that seat, and both Mike Michaud and Shelley Pingree, and I mean, it's a scrum.
Yeah. In all your years covering Maine politics, have you ever experienced a week like this where there have been such bombshells that have really national ripples and ramifications?
This is probably the biggest one. I mean, I haven't covered, I've been a foreign correspondent, from Maine originally, but I've been a foreign correspondent and covered national stuff. So I've only covered Maine politics intensively for a couple of years, but it's absolutely the largest one of the past 2 years that's happened up here. And because it does, you know, the Senator Snow and Collins have both had a kingmaker role within the United States Senate because it's so bitterly divided, and they're almost the only remaining senators of the sort of, you know, Yankee Teddy Roosevelt Republican camp left, and who are possibly might switch sides on key issues. So they become, they have enormous power. For Maine to have its two senators have that amount of power has been just staggering, and suddenly one of them is leaving.
Yeah,
it's a major event, and of course has implications for whether or not the whether Democrats or Republicans will control the United States Senate going forward, which will affect all of us dramatically one way or the other.
One thing that you know, I was really interested in too, the Senate had a big vote on contraception today, and Senator Snow was the only Republican who voted against the majority, well, against the Republicans, and voted with a majority. Do you think that Snow will be really more completely independent for the rest of her time in the Senate for voting? Do you think she'll really, you know, because she doesn't have a re-election to worry about anymore?
I should think so. I mean, now, there was this sense that she was definitely drifting to the right in order to, you know, for her electoral prospects and for survival within her party. I think now she's announced. She's absolutely appalled with the fractured and nature of and polarized nature and the dysfunctional nature of the Senate, much of which is frankly due to her own party's positions. And having said so, she has absolutely nothing to lose. So I think for the remainder of her term, we will probably see the true unadulterated Olympia Snow, you know, not worrying about triangulation or who she's offending or re-election. And I think that will be interesting to see.
Yeah,
and it will probably very much resemble the Olympia Snow of, you know, six, seven, eight yep. years ago. Or,
yep. It's, yeah, well, I mean, I can't imagine how much more of a interesting scenario things are going to play out here in Maine in the next, between now and November. I mean, you have the, now possibly all the congressional seats open for re-election, and then, of course, the equality issues that are coming to the ballot.
And control of the Maine Senate and Maine House are both up for grabs. I mean, yeah. Everything's in potential flux.
Absolutely. One thing that it seems like Senator Snow, really, or excuse me, Congresswoman Senator Snow is really maybe aiming towards is this the Americans elect group of people. What do you have to say about Americans elect? Are you familiar with?
I am a bit. I mean, she did make a statement that she's. The New York Magazine had a blog post coming out saying, well, is she maybe going to run as the Americans elect presidential candidate? And she has absolutely ruled that out today. But it's one paragraph of her one-page statement when she resigned spoke in language which is oddly similar to that of Americans elect and no labels and even the one main group here, which independent candidate Elliot Cutler had set up. I mean, it's very similar in its formulations and constructions, which immediately raised eyebrows. It's so specific that she intends that she feels that the Senate is totally dysfunctional and that she could have more effect outside the Senate and working in this sort of bipartisan, you know, bring everyone together at the center kind of movement. So what that means that she's going to do, it certainly sounds like it's something related to that suite of organizations, what her role is. I don't think it's going to be as the presidential nominee, but what exactly it is, it will be very intrigued to find out if we learn more tomorrow about that. But the language was too specific for it not to have something to do with that movement or at least that impulse.
Right. Well, again, so much to watch and to keep an eye out for. We just have a few minutes left. You also, I mean, there's so much to talk about with you, Colin, but one thing that I just wanted to really briefly touch on, I just want to give a notice to your new book that you have, The American Nations, The History of 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. It's a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
Do you just want to briefly touch on what the story is with that?
Sure, absolutely. It's a book about American regionalism. It argues that we've never been one America from the beginning. Our history was that the separate colonial clusters that were set up in New England and in the Tidewater country of the Chesapeake and around Charleston in the Deep South and so on and so forth were around the Dutch colony around the Big Apple in New York City were separate countries, really. They were founded by people with distinct ethnographic, religious, and political models and goals, and have remained so. I mean, they are separate stateless nations in the sort of European sense of it, and always have been. And it's only by an accident that they ended up being drawn together from a common threat in 1775 and 1776, and even then operated as sort of this loose NATO-like alliance, you know, that had difficulty agreeing on much of anything, and took years to actually find themselves in a federation. And all the, if you understand that and you trace it through our history, which this book does, from that time period all the way through to today's election maps and divisions, it has remained constant, and those separate regional cultures expanded and colonized mutually exclusive portions of the country, and their influence can be seen in most everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the reason we argue about American ideals is because each of these separate nations had a different take on what the American ideal was in all sorts of ways. And if you start realizing that, our history and our Constitution and our current political debate make a great deal more sense.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think is so telling is I used to live in New Mexico for a long time, which is so hard to imagine that you have such different histories of colonization and
absolutely.
Oppression.
New Mexico is a fantastic example.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's where the European colonization of North America began, in New Mexico, well prior to the Puritan arrival.
1500s, yes. So we're just about out of time, but Colin, I really wanted to thank you for braving the elements tonight, for coming in, for making the trek across the USM campus, maybe.
Absolutely.
So if you're interested, Colin has a blog, and you update that pretty regularly.
Yeah.
ColinWoodard.blogspot.com. And you'll be, just out of curiosity really quickly, what's your more projects on the...
Working on a book project proposal right now, which I won't share publicly quite right now, and also working with Alan Caron, who used to be with GrowSmart Maine and is with a think tank called Envision Maine, on trying to articulate a vision of the future of Maine's economy. We have a fractured view of what, you know, a view of what the past was, and a weird fractured view of the present, but we don't kind of have this. What could we be? What are we becoming? What should Maine become? And I think that's our Achilles heel, is that we don't see it. And until we sort of do, we won't be able to sort of move towards that. So I'm busy with that as well. And, of course, covering stuff as it happens.
Great. And I think, you know, LePage would be another great example of just that again, because, I mean, he has such a history of from the industrial sort of aspect of Maine's past. And, you know, there's so much of the creative culture and the economic or the like wind power and everything that can happen here is just sort of very much out of flux time for that. So
absolutely.
A lot of very interesting things coming down. Thank you again to Colin so much for coming tonight. Colin Woodard, journalist, author. You can find his blog, colinwoodard.blogspot.com. Thank you again to Jessica for braving the elements and trucking it down here from the East End. My name is Stephen Emmons. This is Big Talk on WMPG. Stay tuned. Don't know if Cinema Hits and Misses is indeed on tonight. So Cinema Hits and Misses coming up next on WMPG. Thank you so much for listening.